or you can order online at jetspizza.com. Disability Beat is also sponsored in part by attorney Baku Patel of Patel Law, who practices Social Security disability law and represents those who have been denied benefits. There are no fees unless Patel Law wins your case. You can contact Patel Law for a free consultation to discuss your Social Security disability case. Patel Law is located at 108 West University Avenue in Urbana, with offices in Danville and Decatur. For more information, visit patellawteam.com or call 217-384-1111. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat.
My name is Drew Bargeman from the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District. You're listening to Disability Beat on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Tony Pulowski, executive director of the ARC of Illinois, for an update on the politics of disability services in Illinois. But first, disability news for the week of June 13, 2016, from Disability Scoop and Inclusion Daily Express. Those behind a brain training program that claimed to improve autism and a slew of other serious conditions will pay up under a settlement with federal officials. The developers and marketers of Learning RX will pay $200,000 under a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission and have agreed to stop making several false and unsubstantiated claims about their programs. According to the FTC, Learning RX Franchise Corporation and its CEO, Ken Gibson, claimed that the programs offered at their more than 80 franchise locations across the country were clinically proven to improve a wide range of conditions, including autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, Alzheimer's disease, and stroke. The offerings were promoted in print and radio advertisements, direct mail pieces, and in online ads, targeted toward consumers who searched items like autism cure and Asperger cure, the FTC said. According to Jessica Rich, director of the FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection, quote, companies that say they can significantly improve serious health conditions or how your brain functions in everyday situations need to back up those claims with sound science. In this case, the defendants couldn't show their training provides the health or other real-world benefits they claimed, end quote. Under the proposed order settling the FTC allegations filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Colorado, there is a judgment of $4 million against Learning RX, but that will be suspended so long as the company pays the initial fine. The Supreme Court agreed last week to decide how the state that leads the nation in executions determines who is mentally competent enough to die. The justices at first announced that they would take up a more significant issue in the Texas case, whether executing a condemned prisoner after decades on death row constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. But more than 2 hours after issuing its original order, the court corrected its mistake. The Texas case of Bobby James Moore dates back to 1980 when he shot and killed a grocery store clerk during a botched robbery. His attorneys say Moore's mental competency was gauged using a decades-old definition of intellectual disability rather than current medical standards. The court has tightened sentencing rules for people with intellectual disability since 2002 when it issued a landmark decision declaring it unconstitutional for states to execute them. In 2014, it barred states from using a single strict IQ standard to determine a prisoner's competency. The Texas case could tighten those standards further. A coming-of-age documentary about a man with autism is set to debut at theaters across the country this summer. Life Animated will be released starting July 1st at movie theaters in New York and Los Angeles, with at least a dozen other markets already committed to showing the film later in July and August. The film is based on the best-selling book Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism by Pulitzer Prize winner Ron Suskind about his son Owen, who has autism. After he stopped speaking at age 3, Owen Suskind learned to communicate and relate to the world around him again through his love of Disney animation. The film tells the story of Owen reaching adulthood by intertwining video of him with scenes from Disney classics and animation based on Owen's drawings. Life Animated won an award for directing when it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And finally, two stories regarding subminimum wage. Hillary Clinton has called to raise the minimum wage for Americans with disabilities who earn pennies per hour in sheltered work sites across the country. The lower pay permitted by a policy in place since 1938 has been scrapped for federally contracted employees, and both Clinton and Bernie Sanders say states should do the same. The issue is hardly one of economics alone, however. It pits individuals' capabilities and dignity against a business model built on a cheap labor pool willing, day in and day out, to stuff envelopes or fold bath towels. As many as 241,000 workers earn less than the national minimum of $7.25 because their intellectual or developmental disabilities, such as autism or Down syndrome, have an effect on job performance, according to U.S. Department of Labor data. Most have positions in segregated workshops that solicit contracts for light assembly and other simple repetitive tasks. The National Council on Disability, the federal agency that drafted the 1990 landmark Anti-Discrimination Act, recommended in 2012 that the subminimum wage for people with disabilities be discontinued. 2 years later, President Barack Obama signed an executive order ending the practice for those working under federal contracts. Now, Democratic presidential candidates are hammering the 78-year-old legal loophole. Clinton said, quote, "Right now there is a tiered wage when it comes to facilities that do provide opportunities, but not at a self-sufficient wage that enables people to gain a degree of independence as far as they can go," end quote. The press office of Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, has not yet responded to questions regarding the subminimum wage. Trump drew condemnation from people with disabilities and their advocates in November when he mimicked a news reporter's physical impairment during a speech. New Hampshire banned the subminimum wage last year, a step taken in 2003 by Vermont, and legislation recently approved in Maryland will do the same. In February, an administrative law judge ruled that three workers with disabilities in Ohio who made an average $2.50 an hour were entitled to the state minimum, currently $8.10, plus $54,000 in damages and back pay. And the second story. After he graduated from high school, Jack Berry took a job alongside more than 100 other workers with disabilities, making a few dollars an hour in a warehouse, putting together shoeshine kits and tie racks. Today, Barry, age 34, who was born with spina bifida and gets around in a wheelchair, makes $10 an hour working with kids at the YMCA. The assembly line where Barry once worked is no more, phased out as part of a nationwide push to do away with segregated work centers known as sheltered workshops that once employed hundreds of thousands of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities making less than minimum wage. Triangle Incorporated, a Massachusetts disability services provider that until recently housed the largest such center in the state, has closed its in-house work site and now places only people only in jobs in the community where they work side by side with other employees. This summer, the 45-year-old nonprofit will surrender its federal and state certifications that allow it to pay workers with disabilities less than minimum wage. Said Coleman Nee, chief executive of Triangle, quote, "It's a human rights issue. Everybody has the ability to be competitively placed if that's what they want, regardless of the nature of their disability and how much work it might take to get them there," end quote. And that's the news for this week.
Trying to make a living. Trying to make a living. Well, I'm trying to make a living. Best thing I can do. I'm gonna pawn my coat. I'm gonna pawn my shoes. I'm gonna pawn these clothes that ain't never been used. I'm gonna pawn my watch. I'm gonna pawn my ring. I'm telling you people, I'm a pawn everything. I'm trying to make a living. Trying to make a living. Yeah, I'm trying to make a living. Best thing I can do. Well, I'm trying to make a living. Trying to make a living. Yeah, I'm trying to make a living. Trying to make a living.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nice-Wonder, joined today by my who is becoming my most frequent guest on the program, Tony Pulowski, my good friend, who is the executive director of the ARC of Illinois, and I might add, soon to retire at the end of this year. So we will be missing his great expertise in so many areas of concern for people with disabilities in the state of Illinois. So welcome to the program, Tony.
Hey, Vicki. Pleased to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
You know, I picked up the newspaper this morning, and there's so much going on in Springfield, I just don't even know where to begin. So when I invited you to come on the show, I thought, well, you know, you're one of the most knowledgeable people out there when it comes to politics in Illinois and how it's impacting people with disabilities. I'm going to let you pick and inform the listeners on what you think they need to know and how they can themselves have an impact on what's going on in the state. So what's the first thing going on in your mind?
Well, thanks for the opportunity. First of all, you know, the crisis that we're faced with here in Illinois without having a state budget is much deeper than just the developmental disability system. It really is striking at all levels of the human service safety network, as well as education, special education, all of the things that we hold near and dear as a part of this great democracy. I think that my bottom line, Vicki, would be we can't leave this to just the politics of leaders of both parties and the governor here in Illinois. The people themselves, the grassroots folks, really have to sit down with their people locally, their state senators, their state representatives, and express to them their dismay about what's going on in Illinois. And I don't think it's until, you know, the local legislators begin to feel the need to really strongly sit down with their leaders and say we need to end this mess right now. I think that's the only way we're really going to come to any resolution here. Right now, the news is not very good. I mean, every day I hear of more schools saying that they're not going to, you know, open in the fall. The Chicago public schools has already made that, and their dire financial situation is even worse than I think the state's situation. And what I then try to look at is, what does that mean to special education? And when I ask that question, knowing that at the end of this fiscal year, which ends on June 30th, all programs that are getting what we call federal FOFU dollars, those funds are going to stop. So we're going to see a major impact for special education services. groups like Good Friends at the Illinois Council for Developmental Disabilities, Equip for Equality, you know, important, you know, protective services for people with intellectual and other developmental disabilities, are all going to start beginning to feel this crunch more than they ever have in the past. And the only thing that's protecting our system right now are consent decrees. And I know you've had the court monitor, Ronnie Cohen, on your program. You know, we're lucky to have a strong advocate in that role in these very, very trying times.
Right. Well, you know, there was a bill that was just put on the governor's desk, $3.6 billion with a B.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he has he vetoed that bill, or it's just still sitting there?
Yeah, actually there were two. The one that he vetoed Friday was a much more comprehensive human services and education funding bill, and it had a budget for the entire year. That was vetoed by the governor, and I sent his veto message out to our members this morning. There is still one on his desk that's smaller in nature and more human services disability orientated. In fact, Vicki, that has funding in there for community grants like the ARC's Lifespan Program. I would assume that the Michael Boards would be in there.
I don't believe it is.
a topic near and dear to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't know because, you know, you don't have a line item.
Right.
So that remains unseen. But that's on his desk and being reviewed. And if he doesn't veto it, you know, it will become law without his signature. So we're anticipating a veto of that bill as well. So, you know, if there's any budget agreement, I don't believe there's going to be any budget agreement between now and the election. They're talking about an interim budget. The only way that I think that's going to happen is what I kind of started the program out here is if families begin to talk about what does it mean if our school doesn't open? What does it mean if our schools aren't, you know, receiving the resources that they need for special education? You know, what does that mean to our children and our young adults, as well as, you know, the community disability as well? As I said before, you know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't hear about a new school saying they're not going to open in the fall. There isn't a week that goes by that I don't hear about at least one, sometimes two, you know, important human services programs shutting down in Illinois. And human services is so interconnected. I mean, all those supports and services, you know, depend upon, you know, one another in reaching how it does outreach to our community. So it's not a good situation.
I've heard from some people who seem to be pretty knowledgeable about what's going on in the state who say that they think that there will be no budget until after this governor's term is over. Do you believe that?
Well, I think the next opportunity is you have to look at stepping stones, and what we're faced with now is a political dilemma. And so the next political move is going to be, you know, the elections in November. And I think we'll see something more money than we've ever seen spent on elections before in Illinois, as we saw in this primary. And the outcome of that election, I think, will determine the next steps for a possible budget with tax increases. If the Democrats have a tremendous landslide and maintain and even grow their supermajorities in both the Senate and the House, we will get a different outcome than if the Republicans, you know, make inroads and have major victories in their races, you know, statewide and locally. I think that's going to determine, you know, what happens. If the Democrats expand their supermajorities, I think that they'll be in a position to, you know, push a budget and do override a veto much easier than they have now in the House. If the Republicans win, then I think, you know, the administration will see we're making inroads and we're going to keep continue to go along this path, and the path we will not agree unless, you know, the important reforms that they hold near and dear to them are put into place before any budget agreement is made.
Well, I think you and I would both agree that if there isn't a tax increase in Illinois, that there's not much that's going to change one way or the other. So do you really think that the Democrats would increase the state income tax? Because what I've been hearing is, well, they don't want to be made the bad guys, that they don't want to be have the blame put on them for people having to pay higher income tax in the state. So, you know, the way I'm looking at it, I don't know that there is a win coming out of this election.
That's why I said after the elections play a key role there. And then what would happen is that they would probably do that if that occurred, you know, right at the end of the beginning of the new year, while there would be people that, you know, who are not going to return to office. And then they've got two years before they're, you know, would come up for election again. So, you know, we'll see. That you asked me about the scenario. That's the way that I see it. And there are people that are saying, you know, we could see no state budget as long as the Governor Rauner is in office. And that's just really hard to even imagine to get my mind around.
Well, I appreciate your perspective on that. So that's, you know, gives you a little hope anyway. Just kind of getting back to the idea of advocacy, though, and I know that you and the ARC and lots of groups around the state do spend time with legislators and trying to help them understand the situation for individuals with disabilities in the state and their families and the providers as well. But, you know, that group doesn't have a lot of money. Do you think they have or can have the right impact to make change in the state, or do we just have to leave it to luck?
No, you're right. We don't have the money, but we do have numbers. And unless we have the numbers and the grassroots coming out and having frank discussions with not only the people that are in office, but Vicki, this is an election year. So in your area of the state, you have candidates running for office. They're looking for issues. And aren't disability services important? Shouldn't they be important issues to new candidates seeking office? So there are some opportunities here as well. But again, unless the grassroots, unless families, unless individuals with disabilities are sitting down and talking about what this means to their personal situation, we're not going to get the that's the only way that we go up against the millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions that are going to be spent in this next election cycle.
I know that there are some people listening to this program right now who are listening and saying, yeah, but my voice isn't going to have any impact. What do you say to those people?
If you are a person that has a disability or have a loved one in your family who has a disability, you have to be involved with public policy and your legislators at some level, because your health care, your special education, your employment, fair housing is all impacted, you know, by public policy and the government. So to turn your back on your, you know, your own children or your own situation is not an option.
So I don't want to shortchange you time-wise, but I do know that you are working very hard on a wage bill for direct support professionals. Can you give an update on that?
Well, we were delighted to have so much grassroots support that we passed legislation calling for an increase in wages for direct service professionals to $15 an hour. That bill is now sitting on Governor Rauner's desk, and we're mounting a campaign now to urge him to pass that legislation. So we're hoping that he's going to take a look at that. But, I mean, you know the budget situation as well as I do, and the price tag on that is by the state is said that it's $335 million. So it's a hefty chunk, but it's something that needs to happen. But it's a good example of what can happen when people, you know, focus on specific legislation and talk to their legislators about their support.
I think what a lot of people don't understand, though, is that it's more than just quality of life and a wage increase for direct support professionals. There is a huge shortage of those people in the state. And how's that impacting the community of people with disabilities?
Absolutely. It's what it is it's a recruitment and retention issue, because the average wage now is $9.45 an hour. And people can, you know, make more by going to, McDonald's or IKEA or, other places, because that's not a livable wage. So we're starting to experience a real severe crisis in terms of keeping direct professional staff and recruiting them as well. It's a major issue here in Illinois.
In addition to advocating at the state level and, granted, the national level as well, the ARC does lots of great work. You know, want to take just a minute to tell the folks who are listening about the ARC of Illinois?
Well, I would encourage folks to Google the ARC of Illinois, take a look at some of the important work that we do, and become a member. You know, it's only $25 a year. Click and help us to help fund our advocacy at a very grassroots level. It's how we do our good. It's part of how we fund our good work here in Illinois. And the ARC of Illinois is certainly, if not the, certainly the a major leader in Washington, D.C., and Illinois when it comes to disability issues and legislation.
Well, thank you very much for that and for the work that you do, Tony. Thank you so much for the information shared today. I look forward to having you on the show at least one or two more times before you retire at the end of the year. So thanks very much for being on the program.
Oh, sure, Vicki. Anytime. Do anything for you and your listeners down there.
Thank Great. You. Thank you so much. Tony Pulaski, Executive Director of the ARC of Illinois. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are podcast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com, or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your comments and show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week.